Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 6 of What's It Like? My guest is Kevin Jessup. It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon, and Kevin, shouldn't you be out on the golf course?
Well, I'm sitting looking out the window at it, but there's not many golfers out today. It's cold and chilly down here.
Oh, dear. I'm in California, and it's beautiful. That's what you get for being in Florida.
Yeah.
So did you grow up playing golf?
No, I'm actually not a golfer. I just can't chase the ball and then see myself hitting it and then chasing it again. It seems fruitless.
So you just like the view?
Yeah, I like the view.
Well, that's true. I like grass, too, if I don't have to cut it. So you didn't grow up playing golf. So what was your experience of being a child?
Well, I grew up in a house with 5 kids. I had 4 sisters. We had a dog and a cat. So I think my 4 sisters were always ganging up against me. And my experience was, you know, I was trying to be involved in baseball or football or some kind of athletic activity. And, of course, my family went to church every time the doors were open. We didn't have a choice. We had to go whenever we were told to go.
Was that the biggest impact on you in terms of your philosophy and what you learned about life?
It had a big impact on me, I think. I think later on in life I realized how much of an impact it had on me, more so than when I was younger. But, you know, as you grow older, you always realize how much smarter your parents are the older you get.
So as an adult now, do you follow that same worldview that you had that or your parents had when you were growing up?
I would say that's the foundation for it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your parents obviously impact your beliefs, your view of yourself and your world. What portion of that have you modified and changed?
Well, I've tried to embrace it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is you kind of adapt and become what your environment is. So whatever your environment is, you know, you tend to fit into that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I grew older, I found myself becoming more and more like my parents. And I think my sisters did, too. So we're all still pretty close today after all these years. My mother turned 79 last week. My father has since passed away, but we're all still very, very close. So.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, what was your major challenge in school?
Trying to stay focused. I went through school until the 10th grade, and I never had any problem in making good grades. My problem was just trying to stay focused because some of the classes seemed like they were not as interesting as I thought they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up outside of school getting into some trouble. And at the age of 13, I went on a missionary trip to Mexico with Phil Enloe. And when I came back from that trip, I had really changed. Prior to going on that trip, I was in trouble at school and outside of the home and everything.
We should explain that Phil Enloe is a gospel singer, songwriter, and a mutual friend.
Correct, huh? Well, he took 12 men down to Mexico on a mission trip, and I was the youngest of those 12 guys to go.
Hmm.
And I really saw everything that my parents had been trying to teach me actually put into action on that trip, and it had a major impact on me. And then when I returned back to school that following year after that summer, I got involved with the wrong crowd of people again. And by the time I was 16 years old, I'd been in and out of jail on several occasions and ended up going on the road with Phil for a couple of weeks until I could find another high school that would accept me, as I'd been kicked out of the high school that I was at. And for the next 7 years, I ended up staying on the road with Phil. I finished my high school through correspondence, and I think Phil had a bigger impact on me probably than any other individual in my life.
I would think so. Your dad was alive at the time?
Yeah, he was alive.
But Phil acted like a substitute dad?
Yeah, exactly.
What did you do on the road?
Well, I did everything Phil told me to do. we had a big bus at the time, so I learned how to drive that bus and maintain it and take care of it. And then I would take care of the equipment, setting up the sound and all the recording stuff for each concert that we'd do every night. And then take care of record sales and so forth. And then eventually I began to speak more and more began speaking at youth camps and colleges and high schools around the country, trying to talk to young people about how to keep their nose clean, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But I finished my high school through correspondence on the road traveling with him. And then after that, I went to Bible college in Minneapolis for about a year.
Mm.
Took a 2-year Bible course, compacted into 1 year. And that was really my schooling.
Mm-hmm. And following schooling, what did you do?
Well, I went to work at a McDonald's. And from there, it became, it was all relationship-based that propelled me into where I'm at today. And from McDonald's, the manager there moved to a Zales jewelry store, and I followed him and began working at Zales. I entered into their career development program that they had. And then I went to Springfield, Missouri, which is where the country's largest Zales store was. I'd heard about it, so I drove down there and I met the manager of that store. Ended up going to work for him, and then he left Zales and started his own store, and he opened a second store, and I managed that one for him. And then he retired, and I ended up opening my own jewelry store.
Mm.
I ended up selling Phil his engagement ring when he married Jan, his wife. And then the gentleman that used to work at Zales that I had worked for came out of retirement and came to work for me. So,
wow. Full circle.
Yeah, full circle. And ended up selling that store, and that propelled me into a life of sales outside of retail.
Mm-hmm. So what is it you actually do?
Well, for the last 20 years, I've worked with Fortune 1000 companies developing consumer-oriented promotions designed to acquire new customers, retain customers, create loyalty with their customers. So I've worked with people like Visa, American Express, Bank of America, General Motors, Dell Computers, Best Buy, you name it.
That's quite a list.
Actually worked with about 300 of the Fortune 500 companies developing various programs for them.
So how do you gain customers and maintain loyalty?
Well, gaining a customer is part of having a key ingredient in your product or service that people want or need to have. And creating loyalty is a long-term objective of how to take care of that customer. So there's a whole science to that whole thing.
So do you provide teaching or training to these companies, or do you do the implementation?
Well, we go in and look at what their long-term specific marketing objectives are, and then we take that and develop a plan that will give them something to offer to the public that will drive them into their place of business. For example, it might be, purchase a Cadillac and get a free week-long cruise, or finance your Dell computer and get a free companion airline ticket.
I see.
Or sign up for cable or DirecTV and get $100 in gift cards or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you make the arrangements for those kinds of promotions?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to know a bunch of people in the travel industry, for example, in order to make that pay off for you.
Right. Well, I worked for a company for 15 years, which is Thomas Cook, which is the second largest travel company in the world. And my title there was Strategic Alliance Development.
Oh. I always went to Thomas Cook to trade in my money.
Yeah.
If I were exchanging money or something, wherever you are, you can always find a Thomas Cook.
Yeah, and Thomas Cook eventually sold that business to American Express.
Mm-hmm.
So now the American Express Traveler's Check is well known, but few people know that it was started by Thomas Cook.
Yeah. So you're a marketer.
Marketer, yeah. It's very interesting to see how you can modify and change the behavior of people through marketing.
Well, give me the short course. How do you impact people?
So you impact people by, you know, ultimately giving them something of value above and beyond what they think they need or should have. We see it in advertising all the time, naturally, of course, where, you know, you're led to believe that you need that.
Mm-hmm.
You need that house. You need that set of clothes. You need those shoes. You need this or you need that. So marketing has a big impact on the perceived value that people think they need this or they need that. In reality, we can do away with much less, but got to have the latest, greatest iPad or iPhone or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm.
Is it best to show the product in action so that it is, I'm using this because it gives me pleasure or connection with others or some other value?
Absolutely. Not only that, it's prestige. It's part of, you know, feeling like I'm part of something that is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I should have this. If I don't have this, I'm out of the norm.
So is marketing just like high school? You got to be part of the cool kids club?
Just about. Seems to be.
Yeah. What's the best part of your job?
I think meeting people, networking with people, learning from people.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned to be a good listener, how to ask good questions, and then really listen and intake what people are saying.
And what has surprised you about your job?
The fact that you can take it as far as you want. You can do anything you want. You can earn as much as you want. Sales and marketing is a little bit different than an hourly job.
Mm-hmm.
Because in sales and marketing, it's kind of like a doctor or a lawyer. And my father used to say, if you want to be a lawyer, then that's fine, but you're going to be dealing with people's problems all the time, and you can only deal with so many of them. And if you're a doctor, you can be prepared to deal with sick people all the time, and you can only deal with so many of those. But in sales, you can create your own path, go as far as you want, earn as much as you want, and deal with as many people as you want, and choose to who you want to deal with.
Mm.
If you don't like to deal with someone, then you don't have to. When you're a doctor, you can't do that.
You can always move on to selling somebody else.
Yeah.
We'll have more with Kevin Jessup right after this reminder. It's just a nudge to remember the good work being done by the American Red Cross. It's time to put something on your to-do list. It's something you should do. Go to redcross.org. They're doing good work and they need your help. Click on Giving and Get Involved and donate something to the cause. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. And don't forget to get prepared yourself for emergency situations. Go to their store and check out the Personal Safety Emergency Pack. Do yourself a favor. Give to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. We're back with Kevin. So, Kevin, you don't play golf, but do you have a hobby or a life passion of some kind?
Well, this is probably going to sound odd, but I think my work, when it comes to sales and marketing, has become a passion, because it's almost like I mentioned a moment ago, if you're in the medical field or in the law field, you're always learning, because laws change, medicine changes and improves all the time, and sales does the same as well. So it's a lifelong process, just like you're ever learning in the fields of law and medicine. In the area of sales, it's an ongoing process of learning, and the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know very much. But I think that's been a lifelong passion for me. Is it's a profession. Sales is an ongoing education, and learning how, I've always said, if you want to control the end result, you have to control the process.
Mm.
And the art of selling is actually a process, and you learn to control that process in a way that's beneficial for all parties involved. And I think that's been a life passion of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of teaching about sales and how sales and marketing actually take place and work to the benefit of all the parties that are involved. And so that's been a life passion. I'm also an avid football fanatic, I should say. So I hope that the NFL CBA gets out of the way pretty quick so we can have a season next year. and beyond that, I'm a writer. I love to write.
Oh.
So trying to finish a book now called Alone in a Crowd. and it's a Christian inspirational book meant for young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a lifelong passion for me, is writing.
Well, it sounds like you keep busy. Is it difficult to learn how to sell?
Well, it's like anything else. It does take some study, and anybody can be a salesperson, but there is a process involved in selling. And I liken it to the submarine. If you remember those old World War II movies where, you know, water would start flooding into one compartment and they would shut the door and spin the wheel and run to the next compartment
yes.
in the submarine. And then, you know, shut that door and spin the wheel. And soon the submarine was falling all the way to the bottom of the ocean. And selling, I think, is that way. It's compartmentalized. And from the first compartment, which I call the interview, all the way through the budget steps, the decision steps, finally the presentation steps, and then what I call the post-sale steps, I've broken sales into a five-compartment area. And if you jump to one compartment too fast before covering all the data in the other compartments, you've moved ahead maybe too quickly and blown the process.
Mm. So it starts with an interview?
Yeah, I think the interview process is where you find out what people's objectives are, how they've made decisions, how they're going to make decisions, who makes the decision, what they've done in the past, how it's worked for them.
And whether you have anything that worthwhile to sell them?
Right. And I think it's like anything else. It's the 80-20 rule, where 20% of the salespeople make 80% of the money, and 80% of the salespeople are making only 20% of the money. And the difference is the person who's controlling the process is part of that 20% who's making 80% of the money. And part of that process is that interview process. So most salespeople just simply show you the value and benefits of their product and ask you if you want to buy it.
Right.
Instead of learning first if there's even an opportunity there for you to make a presentation. I don't make a presentation until I see an opportunity that it's going to benefit somebody. If I can't see that, then why even present
mm-hmm.
anything?
Well, that's my major complaint about people who cold call me and start off without any, you know, do you want this? And it's like, well, you don't even know who I am.
Sure.
There's no interview process here.
I think it's fair to state that, you know, I can't sell and you can't buy, but what I'd like to do is exchange some information to see if there's any further need for us to carry on a conversation beyond this.
Yes.
And that's where you start to get the information.
But it's a sharing of information in its own way.
Yeah.
What's the second stage?
Well, the second stage is always the money step, or I call it the upfront close, which is now that I understand your objectives, if I can meet those objectives in a way that's financially capable for you to make, is there any other reason why we can't do business together?
Mm.
And find out what their budgets are, if they have any money set aside to do this, what that might be. That's the second step,
mm-hmm.
is finding that out. There's no reason to pitch a product that costs $100,000 if somebody only has $500 in their budget.
So it's, again, trying to find a match between the level of resources they have and the amount of the price of what you're trying to sell.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And then you go to presentation?
Well, I actually go to the decision step next, which is,
mm.
Again, almost like an upfront close. Is there anything else I need to know or any other reason why we can't do business together? And actually, who makes the decision? Sometimes the decision is made by a board. Sometimes it's made by an individual. And we need to know that. If it's made by a board, then there's no sense in me giving a presentation to a single individual. I want to in front of that board. And if somebody states, well, I can make the presentation to our board on your behalf, nine out of 10 times that fails. So
yes.
they really don't know how to do your job for you. So
right.
The decision step is a big one. And then I think from there you get into the presentation. You know, based on all the information you've gathered at that point, I think I know the perfect thing to give to you. And I'll give you a great example of that. There was a young man who got hired at Sears, and he was in the appliance department. And it was his first day on the job, and he really didn't know what was going on. And a little lady came in and said to him that she needed to buy a heater. And he said, well, you know, the heaters are on aisle 4. And he pointed her in that direction, and she went over there to aisle 4, and she picked out a heater after about 20 minutes, and she brought it back to the counter and said, this is the heater I want to buy. And he rang her up, and he was so excited that he'd made a sale that he then went into the back room where all the group of people who had worked there at Sears for many years were sitting, and they were having their coffee and donuts. And he said, hey, guys, I just made my first sale. And they all looked at him in amazement, like, wait a minute, there's a new kid on the floor, and he just made a sale. He's going to steal all of our commissions. We got to do something about this. And the company thought, well, this kid is good. Let's send him to Product Knowledge School, which they did. So he goes to Product Knowledge School, and he learns everything about these appliances, especially the heaters. He learns that they have, you know, extension cords and so many BTUs and safety shutoff switches and all of this kind of stuff. So he goes back to Sears after Product Knowledge School, and another little lady comes in, and she says, Sonny, I need a heater. And he said to her, he said, ma'am, we have heaters. Boy, do we have heaters. Let me show you all of our heaters. And he walked her over to aisle 4, and he gave her the most amazing presentation of all the statistics and everything that he had just learned about all of these heaters. And then he looked at her and he said, which one would you like? And she, of course, said, I don't know, I'm a little confused. I think I'll wait a while. And she left. And he wondered, I can't believe after that amazing presentation of all of these heaters, she couldn't find one. So finally he learned the key to sales, and I call it the dummy curve. If you remember Columbo on TV, mm-hmm. he was always kind of the dummy. And so he learned how to ask the right questions. And so finally, eventually another lady comes into the store, and she says, Sonny, I need to buy a heater. And he said, well, that's interesting. Can I ask you a few questions first? And she said, certainly. And he said, I appreciate that. He said, tell me what you need the heater for. And she said, well, my husband has a workshop outside in the garage. And he said, well, how big is the garage? She told him. And he said, well, is there a plug-in out there? And she said, no, we have to run extensions all the way to the house. And the garage door opens up to the north, and the wind comes in, and it gets really chilly out there, and I want him to have a heater. And they talk for a minute or two, and finally he says, you know what, based on all the information you've just shared with me, I think I know the perfect heater that'll meet the need you're looking for. And he took her over to aisle 4, and he picked the heater off the shelf, and he said, this is it. And she said, I'll take it. And so now he's gone from an order taker to a product knowledge whiz to the dummy, and he's learned the key to successful selling. And simply by asking those few questions that he failed to do in the first two attempts, he's actually made his first sale. So that's kind of a poor example, but gives you the idea of the process.
Well, he's using his knowledge rather than just spouting it.
Yeah, it's not the knowledge. I mean, you have to have product knowledge, but you really have to have the insight of your customer first.
Right. Having the product knowledge is one thing, but you don't actually necessarily need to give it all to the customer.
Right, right. Yeah, I used to say, don't ever answer an unasked question.
Mm-hmm. But sales seems like a lot of self-motivation.
It can be, I think. The sales mm-hmm. is a lot of psychology.
Yeah. How do you, when you need to, how do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Sometimes it's hard for salespeople. And a lot of times I find myself going through cycles where you're very on, and other times where you just need a break. But I think the best thing is to get involved. So I'll pick up the phone, I'll make a phone call, I'll make a cold call, and just get involved. Just showing up is a big part of the program. And once you start getting involved, you start to find a rhythm to your call patterns, to what it is you're doing in the process of your business day to day. And you have to have some kind of a routine, but show up and get involved.
Mm-hmm. You can't be a writer without writing, and you can't be a salesperson without making calls or getting involved in the process.
Yeah, I mean, there's always some preparatory work that takes place, and I like what Abe Lincoln said one time when he said, you know, if there's 16 hours to chop down a cherry tree, I'm going to spend 8 hours sharpening the axe. So you do have to spend some time sharpening your own axe. Mm-hmm. And I think you also have to begin with the end in mind, which is what am I trying to accomplish today or this week or next month or this year? And every year that rolls around, I always put my annual goal together of what I want to accomplish. And then I break it down into monthly and weekly and even daily goals. So I have some kind of a roadmap to measure my success by.
Mm.
And if you don't have that, then sometimes you get lost and 3 or 4 months pass by and you feel like, well, I'm not doing anything. What's happening in my life or what's happening in my career? And you know, I just don't have any passion. And that's because you don't have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have some kind of a plan first to start with, and I call it beginning with the end in mind.
When you need to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Well, it's I have a little book I keep near to me, and it's a very short book. It was written in the late 1800s, and I've read it 1,000 times, and I'll probably read it another 1,000 times. It was written by a gentleman by the name of James Allen, and it's entitled As a Man Thinketh, and it's probably the most insightful book I've ever read. I think you could buy it at Barnes & Noble for $2.99. I read that book over and over again, and it continues to put me where I need to be in my thought processes, in my own life, and it's, besides the Bible, it's been the most impactful book that I've ever read, and it's amazing that so many people haven't heard of it. But As a Man Thinketh is a critical book for me.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to your core?
I think I grew up with my mother and my sisters and my stepfather. And when I was a year old, my father had left us. And when I was 17 years old, actually on the road traveling with Phil, I met my real father for the very first time. And that had a big impact on me because I saw myself in the mirror, and I'd never thought I would experience anything like that. I didn't know that my stepfather was not my real father. When I met my real father and I called my mother and everything came clear, it was a pretty incredible experience. And he turned out to be a wonderful man, and we had a great relationship. He passed away a few years later. But he encouraged me to go into the world of sales, and probably had a bigger impact on the direction of my life today than anybody.
Was it a chance meeting, or did you set out to find him?
It was really a chance meeting. Phil and I were singing at a church in Kansas City, Missouri, and my grandfather, whom I'd never met, was at that concert and introduced himself through the pastor of the church to Phil and I. And that evening, he called my father, which was living in Arizona at the time, and had a conversation with my father over the phone. And then Phil and I were on our way to Arizona to do a concert. So we met down there. And when I met my father, he had a box of letters and materials and all kinds of things that he'd saved over the years that had been sent and sent back. It was a very eye-opening experience.
Yes, I guess.
Very incredible.
If you were giving high school graduation advice, kind of your own speech here, what would it be?
Well, I think it's look beyond yourself and try to find what it is you really want to do, knowing that as unattainable as it might sound at the time, you can really do anything. You can do anything with your life. I would hand out to every person in that high school that little book, As a Man Thinketh.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell them to start planning what it is they want to do. When I was in high school, I didn't plan. I didn't have any idea what I was doing, and I really didn't care. I mean, I think we're so young that, you just don't think that way. I think young people today think more that way. But if you want to have a career and a good life, you really have to plan ahead. Have to have some kind of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
So listen to your teachers. Listen to your parents. They were the enemy when I was in school. They're really not the enemy. As I got out of school, I realized these people are really here to help me and to help better my life. And I don't know how to get that across to young people. But I go into high schools today, and I see everybody wanting to be a movie star, an athlete, a rap star, all of these kinds of things. But the young people dress alike, look alike. They're only concerned about what's going to happen this weekend. But for the individual who looks beyond all of that and looks to the future and begins to plan something with their life, a plan has a lot of moving parts to it. My experience with Phil on the road opened up doors to relationships that I still have today. And those relationships that people develop lead to things that happen in your life that have never-ending impact.
Mm-hmm.
Life is really not about who you are or what you do. It's about the relationships you create. When my father died, he wanted on his tombstone a man who had many friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on his tombstone, and that's what he wanted, and he did. He had an enormous amount of friends.
Mm-hmm.
Those friends, those people, those are the important things in life, are relationships and people.
Right.
Those relationships will open up doors for job opportunities, for other relationships, maybe even finding the mate in life as you go through life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are the key elements.
Thanks. Last question is to help me get better at this process. So think of an event that in your life that we haven't talked about. What question, I didn't ask all the questions, and so what question should I have asked that would have made you tell that story?
Oh, wow. I do think that the book that I'm attempting to write called Alone in the Crowd is an important book for young people, especially today. Because so many times I think each and every one of us at one point in life has felt like we were alone in a crowd.
Right. How did you decide to write this book?
Well, I began to look back on what I had gone through in my own life and why I acted out and why I did some of the things I did that put me on the path that I, had to run on later in life. And I realized that a lot of it was just trying to fit into the mold. When you go into high schools today, you're either a jock, you're in music, you're in fashion, you're in, you fit into a category somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a few of those kids that just don't seem to fit into any category.
Right.
And maybe their home life isn't well. Maybe they just don't fit in anywhere, and they're just alone. They're in a crowd, but they're alone. And I see those young people from time to time, and I just want to encourage them. You don't have to fit into a certain mold. Just be who you are and be confident in who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So being alone in the crowd could be my mother after my father died. She felt as if no one in the world could understand how she was decimated when he passed away, and she was a widow.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that she was alone in the crowd.
Right. Lots of people around you, but you feel like you're the only one with those feelings.
Right. I've talked to young women who, young men who've gone through drug rehab and in and out of prison, and I've talked to all kinds of young people. I've talked to star athletes. I've talked to NFL athletes and Olympic athletes, and you know, they all at one point felt alone in a crowd. So
right.
I think that there's, I think everybody goes through that and can relate to that to some extent. But yet we're not, you're never alone.
Mm-hmm.
You're never alone. So we can always reach out, and that's where the relationships in our life mean more than anything. So I think there's a lot to be said about somebody who's trying to accomplish something and they feel all alone when they're trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There are people out there that make a difference, and we make a difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we say, everything we do has an impact, whether we realize it or not.
I want to thank Kevin Jessup for joining me. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.